Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is September 21st, 2018, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is You're So Vain: Interosseous versus Intravenous Access for Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest. And our guest skeptic is Andrew Merrillman. He is a critical care paramedic and a first-year student at Rocky Vista University in Colorado. His primary interests are resuscitation, pre-hospital critical care, airway management, and hocus-pocus, that point-of-care ultrasound. Welcome to the SGEM, Andrew.
Thanks, Ken, for having me. It's great to be on your show. I appreciate it.
Well, sorry there was a little bit of difficulty at the start here because we were going back and forth, and I should have realized Colorado. That's out west. And here I'm thinking very sort of, you know, time zone centric that everybody would be on Eastern Standard Time. But you're out in the mountains, aren't you?
Yes. And I'm also still adjusting to the time change. So it certainly leads to the confusion.
Adjusting? Why? Where did you move from?
So I lived in New Hampshire previously, and I'm originally from Vermont.
I'm not picking up much of an accent, though.
Nope, I'd never obtain the accent.
You never obtain. Well, maybe you have to go back there and gulp down some more maple syrup and smooth out that voice so you get that. You know who has a New England accent, though, like a Vermont one, is Megan Groth. She has an excellent one, and she's been on the program a number of times. Anyways, before we get started, I'm a little curious. I mean, you know, critical care paramedic, that's a, you know, really enjoyable job. You know, you've got a great career. And you're going back to school, to medical school. Do you have some really strong desire to go $200,000 in debt?
Well, surprisingly, debt wasn't the primary reason. Before I was a paramedic, I did always plan on being a physician, and eventually made the decision to go back, really just to have more of an impact on patient care and also to be able to do more in the pre-hospital realm. So I'll always be a paramedic and stay involved there.
Well, I'm sure the paramedic training and experience will be invaluable in your medical school training and stuff like that. And it certainly sounds like you're a mature student, and I'm not talking about age, I'm talking about maturity. So you've already had a career, and I think that adds to something when you're a medical student, that you have some life experience. It's not that people that don't have a career prior can't make great physicians. I think just it adds something. So good for you, and good luck with the rest of your training.
Well, I appreciate that. And yeah, I think it does help. It certainly levels the playing field, though, being in medical school. It's a lot of work, and everyone's struggling the same way. So,
all right, well, let's start with a case. What do you got for me?
All right, so we have a 46-year-old man who has a cardiac arrest at home, witnessed by his family. Bystander CPR is initiated prior to ambulance arrival. EMS arrives on scene and initiates high-quality basic life support. One defibrillation for ventricular fibrillation is provided, but the patient remains in ventricular fibrillation. As part of the protocol, they attempt vascular access to administer epinephrine and an antidysrhythmic. They wonder whether it would be better to attempt a peripheral IV first or an IO first.
All right, well, cardiac arrest care has really evolved dramatically over the last couple of decades, but not in the way many may have expected. We now know that an emphasis on basic, and what I mean by basic is high-quality chest compressions and defibrillation, are the most important aspects of resuscitation. More advanced skills such as airway management, vascular access, and cardiac medications are being de-emphasized.
Yeah, it was the classic Opals paper covered on SGEM 64 by the legend of emergency medicine, Dr. Ian Steele, that demonstrated no advantage to ACLS versus BLS for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
Oh yes, Ian Steele. He is a legend. Well, there have been other SGEM episodes that question the efficacy of various interventions. And you know what? I'll put a link to the show notes for all those other episodes.
Yeah, the resuscitation science community has been struggling to find advanced interventions that can show a benefit in mortality and, most importantly, survival with good neurological outcome.
Yeah, we want to win. And I think a lot of us, and certainly the patients, would consider it a win if they left the front door of the hospital playing the piano, if, of course, they could play the piano originally. But, you know, you want people to survive neurologically intact. Just alive versus dead might be too crude of an outcome. So we want to see them with good neurologic outcome. Well, interosseous access has become a mainstay of cardiac arrest care due to its speed and reliability. However, no study has compared intravenous access to intraosseous access. Oh, until now. What's the clinical question?
So, is intraosseous vascular access in the pre-hospital setting for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest associated with better neurological outcomes compared to intravenous vascular access?
And the reference, Andrew?
The reference is Kuano et al. Intraosseous vascular access is associated with lower survival and neurologic recovery among patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and that was in Annals of EM in May of this year.
All right, let's run through the PICO. What was their population?
So it was out-of-hospital, non-traumatic adult cardiac arrest patients.
And they excluded patients that had unsuccessful attempts or had more than one access site. And patients were also excluded if they were incarcerated, pregnant, those with DNR or do not resuscitate orders, and those with arrests presumed to be the result of exsanguination or severe burns. How about the intervention?
So the intervention was primary intraosseous vascular access.
That's right. They went IO. And what did they compare it to?
Compared it to primary intravenous vascular access.
That's right, IV. Okay, let's go through the outcomes. What was the primary outcome?
Favorable neurological outcome, and that was defined as a modified Rankin scale of less than or equal to 3.
Yeah, so the modified Rankin scale score had to be less than or equal to 3. How about the secondary outcomes?
That was return of spontaneous circulation and survival to hospital discharge.
Yeah, so if they got ROSCE or they left the hospital alive. The author's conclusions were, quote, in adult out-of-hospital cardiac arrest patients, intraosseous vascular access was associated with poorer neurologic outcomes than intravenous access, end of quote. All right, let's go through the quality checklist for a chart review. Were the abstracts trained before the data collected?
We're unsure. They did not provide much specific information. The top of the methods section does say trained research assistants reviewed the neurologic outcomes as part of the ROC primed trial. They don't specify who abstracted this data for secondary analysis.
Well, were the inclusion and exclusion criteria for case selections defined?
Yes, they were.
How about the variables? Were they defined?
Yes.
Did the abstractors use a data abstract form?
Also unsure, the data was prospectively collected for the ROC Prime trial, quote, using a standardized report form consistent with Utstein standards. This is a sub-analysis of that trial, and we couldn't find any specifics in the publication.
All right, well, what about the abstractor's performance? Was it monitored?
This was not applicable.
And were the abstracts aware of the hypothesis or the study objectives?
No, trained ROC research assistants were unaware of this post hoc study hypothesis when reviewing neurologic outcomes at hospital discharge from hospital records in the initial data.
All right. How about inter-observer reliability? Was it discussed in the manuscript?
No, it was not.
Did they test it or measure it?
No.
Oh, okay. Was the medical record database identified or described?
Yes.
Was the method of sampling described?
Not applicable because it was not described.
All right. And how about number 11? Was the statistical management of missing data described?
Yes. Multiple imputation was done for the primary analysis to minimize bias resulting from missing data.
And the last question on the quality checklist for a chart review, was the study approved by the institution or ethics review board?
Yes, it was.
All right, now we have a second checklist because that was for a chart review. And that chart review checklist comes from Worcester et al., my EBM mentor out of McMaster. But there's also a quality checklist for observational studies. So we're just going to run through those really quickly, yes, no kind of stuff. So did the study address a clearly focused issue?
Yes, it did.
Did the authors use the appropriate method to answer their question?
Yes, but the method only addresses associations, not causation.
Hey, don't get into the nerdy section yet. Okay, was the cohort recruited in an acceptable way?
Yes.
Was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes.
How about the outcome? Was it accurately measured to minimize bias?
We're unsure.
Did the authors identify all important confounding factors?
No.
Was the follow-up complete enough?
Yes.
How precise were the results?
95% confidence interval around the point estimate for the primary and secondary outcomes was fairly wide.
See, I've got you sounding nerdy already, Andrew. Okay, do you believe the results?
No.
Can the results be applied to your local population?
No, they cannot.
Do the results of this study fit with other available evidence?
No.
All right, let's run through the key results. The study included just over 13,000 patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and the vast majority, and what I mean by vast majority is the vast majority, 95%, yeah, 95% had intravenous or IV access. That means only 5% in the group had IOs or interosseous access. What was the main result, though?
Significantly fewer patients had a favorable neurologic outcome in the IO group compared to the IV group.
Yeah, and we can drill down to that and look at the modified Rankin scale score of less than or equal to 3 was 1.5%, okay, so 1.5% in the IO group versus 7.6% in the IV. So there's a big gap there between 1.5 and 7.6, I believe, and they told me there'd be no math, about a 6% absolute difference. How about the secondary outcomes?
So the IO was associated with poor survival to hospital discharge and return to spontaneous circulation, and sensitivity analysis revealed similar results.
All right, Andrew, you don't need to hold back anymore because now you can talk nerdy to me. Okay, this was a secondary analysis of the PRIME study, and we'll put a link in the show notes to clinicaltrial.gov for the details of the original study. But we've got how many points, Andrew?
We have 5.
That is right, my favorite number, and I'm going to give you the leadoff one.
All right, so here we have association versus causation, and this is the most obvious limitation with the study design because it cannot conclude causation. The vast majority of patients had IVs placed with only 5% getting an IO. There may have been multiple unmeasured confounders responsible for the EMS crews deciding to use an IO over an IV. A randomized control trial would need to be conducted to answer whether or not IOs actually cause poor neurologic outcomes in these patients.
Excellent. So that gets the big one, the elephant in the room, out of the way. And to the author's credit, they did not claim causation. They talked about association. But the second nerdy point is about the reliability of this scale has been questioned, and I'll put a link in the show notes to that article that questions the reliability of the modified Rankin scale. Inter-rater reliability was not discussed in this paper. It wasn't tested, well, at least it wasn't reported being tested, or measured in the publication.
All right, and number 3, so differences at baseline. There were multiple differences in the population, such as sex, witnessed or not, location of the arrest, and whether or not defibrillation was performed. There was a significant difference in initial rhythm between the two groups. In the IO group, 13.9% had a shockable rhythm, while in the IV group, 26.2% had a shockable rhythm. We know patients with shockable rhythms are more likely to do well. They did attempt to mitigate these issues using various adjustments, including propensity score matching.
And that leads into number 4, and that's about the difference in treatment. There were also differences in treatment between the groups. One example is twice the number of patients in the IV group received interventional cardiac catheterization compared to the IO group. Techniques used to address these issues cannot remove all the potential biases in these types of study designs.
And number 5, so what? At the end of the day, does it really matter if you have vascular access in an adult patient with an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest? We do not have good evidence that ACLS drugs provide a patient-oriented outcome.
Just listening to you say the lead-in to point 5 made me think of Howie Mel, because he has a podcast called So What? Oh, so point number 5, Howie, this one's for you. So what? The recent Paramedic 2 trial is another excellent example of the failure of epinephrine to improve survival with favorable neurologic outcome. Stay tuned, S-Gemmers, because we will be covering this very soon on a future episode. But those are the 5 nerdy points. Andrew, you got through it with full nerdiness. Let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the S-Gem's conclusion.
So we agree with the authors that this data does demonstrate an association of worse outcomes in patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest who had IOs placed compared to IVs.
And how about an S-Gem bottom line?
High-quality CPR and early defibrillation for shockable rhythms are more important in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest than obtaining vascular access.
And can you resolve the case you presented?
Sure. So the responding EMS providers choose to initiate IO access as the fastest, most reliable means. They are then able to administer ACLS medications as per their protocol, knowing it's unlikely to make an important patient-oriented difference.
And how are you going to take this information, this study about IO versus IV, and apply it clinically?
So this secondary analysis should not deter paramedics from obtaining vascular access via IO in cardiac arrest. They should use the approach they think is best for each individual patient. In cardiac arrest, this is typically IO, as it is faster and more reliable than intravenous. Using the fastest method allows more time to focus on the important interventions such as chest compressions and defibrillation.
All right, and the final question is, what do you tell your patient?
So I'm going to tell the family we're putting a tube or cannula directly into the bone. This is faster than starting an IV, and we can give them medication quickly if needed. However, the most important things we know are good CPR and shocking the heart.
It's time to announce the Keener Contest winner, and last week's winner was Matt Gobel, a fourth-year medical student at UC San Diego School of Medicine. He knew in the movie Top Gun, Maverick claimed to have pulled a 4G inverted dive with a MiG-28 at a distance of about 1.5 meters. What's the question this week, Andrew?
So, what year was intraosseous access first described in the literature?
Well, if you know the answer, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. And yes, the prize exists, but you got to play to win, and you got to win to find out what it is. There's some other FOMED on this topic, and I will put it in the show notes. But thank you, Andrew, for taking time from your busy academic schedule, because being a first-year medical student is tough.
I agree. It's been tough, but quite enjoyable.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it. Now, you don't have a New England accent. You don't have a mountain accent. So you're just going to have to say it in your best Andrew voice. What's the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.